instead. She remembers his saying families suck and thinks, it's the Boules. He's brought me here to tell me about the Boules. She isn't surprised to find the thought scares her badly. Lisi, he says, there's something I have to explain. And if it changes your mind about marrying me, Scott, I'm not sure I want to hear. His grin is both weary and frightened. I bet you're not. And I know I don't want to tell. But it's like getting a shot at the doctor's office. No, worse. Like getting a cyst opened or a carbuncle lanced. But some things just have to be done. His brilliant hazel eyes are fixed on hers. Lisi, if we get married, we can't have kids. That's flat. I don't know how badly you want them right now, but you come from a big family and I guess it'd be natural for you to want to fill up a big house with a big family of your own someday. You need to know that if you're with me, that can't happen. And I don't want you to be facing me across a room somewhere 5 or 10 years down the line and screaming, you never told me this was part of the deal. He draws on his cigarette and jets smoke from his nostrils. It rises in a blue-gray fume. He turns back to her. His face is very pale, his eyes enormous. Like jewels, she thinks, fascinated. For the first and only time she sees him not as handsome, which he is not, although in the right light he can be striking, but as beautiful, the way some women are beautiful. This fascinates her, and for some reason horrifies her. I love you too much to lie to you, Lisi. I love you with all that passes from my heart. I suspect that kind of all-out love becomes a burden to a woman in time, but it's the only kind I have to give. I think we're going to be quite a wealthy couple in terms of money, but I'll almost certainly be an emotional pauper all my life. I've got the money coming, but as for the rest, I've got just enough for you, and I won't ever dirty it or dilute it with lies. Not with the words I say, not with the ones I hold back. He sighs, a long, shuddering sound, and places the heel of his hand holding the cigarette against the center of his brow, as if his head hurts. Then he takes it away and looks over at her again. No kids, Lisi. We can't. I can't. Scott, are you... Did a doctor... He's shaking his head. It's not physical. Listen, baby love. It's here. He taps his forehead between the eyes. Lunacy and the Landons go together like peaches and cream, and I'm not talking about an Edgar Allan Poe story or any genteel Victorian We Can Keep Auntie in the Attic ladies novel. I'm talking about the real-world, dangerous kind that runs in the blood. Scott, you're not crazy. But she's thinking about his walking out of the dark and holding the bleeding ruins of his hand out to her. His voice full of jubilation and relief. Crazy relief. She's remembering her own thought as she wrapped that ruin in her blouse. That he might be in love with her, but he was also half in love with death. I am, he says softly. I am crazy. I have delusions and visions. I write them down, that's all. I write them down and people pay me to read them. For a moment, she's too stunned by this, or maybe it's the memory of his mangled hand, which she has deliberately put away from her, that has stunned her, to reply. He is speaking of his craft. That is always how he refers to it in his lectures, never as his art, but as his craft. As delusion. And that is madness. Scott, she says at last, writing's your job. You think you understand that, he says, but you don't understand the gone part. I hope you stay lucky that way, little Lisi. And I'm not going to sit here under this tree and give you the history of the Landons, because I only know a little. I went back 3 generations, got scared of all the blood I was finding on the walls, and quit. I saw enough blood, some of it my own, when I was a kid. Took my daddy's word for the rest. When I was a kid, Daddy said that the Landons, and the Landros before them, split into 2 types, Gomers and Bad Gunky. Bad Gunky was better, because you could let it out by cutting. You had to cut, if you didn't want to spend your life in the bughouse or the jailhouse. He said it was the only way. Are you talking about self-mutilation, Scott? He shrugs as if unsure. She is unsure as well. She has seen him naked, after all. He has a few scars, but only a few. Blood pools, she asks. This time he's more positive. Blood pools, yeah. That night when you stuck your hand through the greenhouse glass, were you letting out the bad gunky? I suppose, sure, in a way. He stubs his cigarette in the grass. He takes a long time and doesn't look at her while he does it. It's complicated. You have to remember how terrible I felt that night. A lot of things had been piling up. I should never have... No, he says, let me finish. I can only say this once. She stills. I was drunk. I was feeling terrible. And I hadn't let it out. It. In a long time. I hadn't had to. Mostly because of you, Lisey. Lisey has a sister who went through an alarming bout of self-mutilation in her early 20s. Amanda's past all that now, thank God, but she bears the scars, mostly high, on her inner arms and thighs. Scott, if you've been cutting yourself, shouldn't you have scars? It's as if he hasn't heard her. Then last spring, long after I thought he'd shut up for good, I'll be good goddamn if he didn't start up talking to me again.
It runs in you, Scoot, I'd hear him say. It runs in your blood just like a sweet mother, don't it?
Who, Scott? Who started talking to you? Knowing it's either Paul or his father, and probably not Paul. Daddy.
He says, Scooter, if you want to be righteous, you better let that bad gunky out. Get after it now. Don't smuck and wait.
So I did. Little. Little. He makes small cutting gestures, one on each cheek, one on his arm to illustrate. Then that night when you were mad, he shrugs. I got after the rest, over and done with, over and out. And we's fine. We's fine. Tell you one thing, I'd bleed myself dry like a hog on a chain before I'd hurt you. Before I'd ever hurt you. His face draws down in an expression of contempt she has never seen before.
I ain't never been like him. My daddy.
And then almost spitting it, fucking Mr. Sparky. She doesn't speak. She doesn't dare. Isn't sure she could, anyway. For the first time in months, she wonders how he could cut his hand so badly and have so little scarring. Surely it isn't possible. She thinks, his hand wasn't just cut, his hand was mangled. Scott, meanwhile, has lit another Herbert Territon with hands that are shaking just the smallest bit. I'll tell you a story, he says, just one story. And let it stand for all the stories of a certain man's childhood. Because stories are what I do. He looks at the rising cigarette smoke. I net them from the pool. I've told you about the pool, right? Yes, Scott, where we all go down to drink.
Yep.
And cast our nets. Sometimes the really brave fisher folk, the Austins, the Dostoevskys, the Faulkners, even launch boats and go out to where the big ones swim, but that pool is tricky. It's bigger than it looks. It's deeper than any man can tell. And it changes its aspect, especially after dark. She says nothing to this. His hand slips around her neck. At some point, he steals inside her unzipped parka to cup her breast. Not out of lust, she's quite sure. For comfort. All right, he says. Story time. Close your eyes, little Lisey. She closes them. For a moment, all is dark as well as silent under the yum-yum tree, but she isn't afraid. There's the smell of him and the bulk of him beside her. There's the feel of his hand, currently resting on the rod of her collarbone. He could choke her easily with that hand, but she doesn't need him to tell her he'd never hurt her, at least not physically. This is just a thing Lisey knows. He will cause her pain, yes, but mostly with his mouth. His everlasting mouth. All right, says the man she will marry in less than a month. This story might have four parts. Part one is called Scooter on the Bench. Once upon a time, there was a boy, a little skinny frightened boy named Scott. Only when his daddy got in the bad gunky and cutting himself wasn't enough to let it out, his daddy called him Scooter. And one day, one bad, mad day, the little boy stood up on a high place, looking down at a polished wooden plane far below, and watching as his brother's blood... 8. Run slowly along the crack between two boards.
Jump,
his father tells him. Not for the first time either.
Jump, you little bastard, you sweet mother chicken cack. Jump right now.
Daddy, I'm afraid. It's too high.
It's not, and I don't give a shit if you're afraid or not, you smuckin' jumper. I'm gonna make you sorry, and your buddy sorrier. Now paratroops over that side.
Daddy pauses for a moment, looking around, eyeballs shifting the way they do when he gets in the bad gunky, almost ticking from side to side. Then he looks back at the three-year-old who stands trembling on the long bench in the front hall of the big old dilapidated farmhouse with its million puffing drafts. Stands there with his back pressed against the stenciled leaves on the pink wall of this farmhouse far in the country where people mind their own business.
You can say Geronimo if you want to, Scoot. They say that sometimes helps. If you scream it real loud when you jump out of the plane.
So Scott does. He will take any help he can get. He screams Geronimo, which isn't quite right and doesn't help anyway because he still can't jump off the bench to the polished wooden floor plane so far below.
Ah, sweet smockin' chicken kikin' Christ.
Daddy yanks Paul forward. Paul is 6 now, 6 going on 7. He is tall and his hair is a darkish blonde, long in front and on the sides. He needs a haircut. Needs to go see Mr. Balmer at the barber shop in Martinsburg, Mr. Balmer with the elk's head on his wall and the faded decal in his window that shows American flag and says, I served. But it will be a while before they go near Martinsburg, and Scott knows it. They don't go to town when Daddy is in the bad gunky, and Daddy won't even go to work for a while, because this is his vacation from U.S. Jip'em. Paul has blue eyes, and Scott loves him more than anyone. More than he loves himself. This morning, Paul's arms are covered with blood, crisscrossed with cuts, and now Daddy goes to his pocket knife again, the hateful pocket knife that has drunk so much of their blood, and raises it up to catch the morning sun. Daddy came downstairs yelling for them, yelling,
Bool! Bool! Get in here, you two!
If the bool's on Paul, he cuts Scott, and if the bool's on Scott, he cuts Paul. Even in the bad gunky, Daddy understands love.
You gonna jump, you coward, or am I gonna have to cut him again?
Don't, Daddy, Scott shrieks. Please don't cut him no more. I'll jump.
Then do so.
Daddy's top lip rolls back to show his teeth. His eyes roll in their sockets. They roll, roll, roll like he's looking for folks in the corners, and maybe he is, probably he is, because sometimes they hear him talking to folks who ain't there. Sometimes Scott and his brother call them the bad gunky folks, and sometimes the bloody bool people.
You do it, Scooter. You do it, you old Scoot. Yell Geronimo and then paratroops over the side. No cowardly kikes in this family. Right now!
Geronimo, he yells, and although his feet tremble and his legs jerk, he still can't make himself jump.
Cowardly legs, cowardly kike legs.
Daddy doesn't give him another chance. Daddy cuts deep into Paul's arm and the blood falls down in a sheet. Some goes on Paul's shorts, some goes on his sneaks, most goes on the floor. Paul grimaces but doesn't cry out. His eyes beg Scott to make it stop, but his mouth stays shut. His mouth will not beg. At U.S. Gypsum, which the boys call U.S. Jip'em because it's what their daddy calls it, the men call Andrew Landon Sparky, or sometimes Mr. Sparks. Now his face looms over Paul's shoulder and his fluff of whitening hair stands up, as if all the electricity he works with has gotten inside him and his crooked teeth show in a Halloween grin and his eyes are empty because Daddy is gone. He's a goner. There's nothing in his shoes but the bad gunky. He's no longer a man or a daddy, but just a blood bull with eyes.
Stay up there this time and I'll cut off his ear,
says the thing with Daddy's electric hair, the thing standing up in their daddy's shoes.
Stay up there next time and I'll cut his mother's smuckin' throat. I don't give a shit. Up to you, Scooter, Scooter, yo, Scoot. You say you love him? You don't love him enough to stop me cutting him, do you? When all you have to do is jump off a sweet mother 3-foot bench? What do you think of that, Paul? What do you got to say to your chicken-cack little brother now?
But Paul says nothing, only looks at his brother, dark blue eyes locked on hazel ones. And this hell will go on for another 2,500 days. 7 endless years. Do what you can and let the rest go, is what Paul's eyes say to Scott. And it breaks his heart. And when he jumps from the bench at last, to what part of him is firmly convinced will be his death, it isn't because of their father's threats, but because his brother's eyes have given him permission to stay right where he is, if in the end he's just too scared to do it. To stay on the bench even if it gets Paul Landon killed. He lands and falls on his knees in the blood on the boards and begins crying, shocked to find he is still alive. And then his father's arm is around him, his father's strong arm is lifting him up, now in love rather than in anger. His father's lips are first on his cheek, then pressed firmly against the corner of his mouth.
See, Scooter, old Scooter, you old Scoot. I knew you could do it.
Then Daddy is saying it's over, the blood pool is over, and Scott can take care of his brother. His father tells him he's brave. One brave little sumbitch, his father says he loves him, and in that moment of victory, Scott doesn't even mind the blood on the floor. He loves his father, too. He loves his crazy blood pool daddy for letting it be over this time, even though he knows, even at 3, he knows, that next time will come. 9. Scott stops, looks around, spies the wine. He doesn't bother with the glass, but drinks straight from the bottle. It really wasn't much of a jump, he says and shrugs. Looked like a lot to a 3-year-old, though.
Scott, my God, Lisi says. How often was he like that?
Often enough. A lot of the times I've blocked out. That time on the bench, though, that one's stone clear. And like I said, it can stand for the rest.
Was he drunk?
No, he almost never drank. Are you ready for part 2 of the story, Lisi?
If it's like part 1, I'm not sure I am.
Don't worry, part 2 is Paul and the good bool. No, I take that back. It's Paul and the best bool. And it was only a few days after the old man made me jump off the bench. He got called into work, and as soon as his truck was out of sight, Paul told me to be good while he went down to Muley's. He stops, laughs, and shakes his head as people do when they realize they're being silly. Mueller's. That's what it really was. I told you about going back to Martinsburg when the bank auctioned off the home place, right? Just before I met you?
No, Scott.
He looks puzzled, for a moment almost frighteningly vague. No?
No.
This isn't the time to tell him he's told her next to nothing about his childhood.
Next to nothing? Nothing at all.
Until today, under the yum-yum tree. Well, he says a little doubtfully, I got a letter from Daddy's bank, First Rural of Pennsylvania, you know, like there was a Second Rural out there somewhere. And they said it was out of court after all these years, and I was set for a piece of the proceeds. So I said what the smuck and went back. First time in 7 years. I graduated Martinsburg Township High when I was 16, took a lot of tests, got a papal dispensation. Surely I told you that.
No, Scott.
He laughs uneasily.
Well, I did. Go you Ravens, Peck'em and Deck'em.
He makes a cawing sound, laughs more uneasily still, then takes a big glug of wine. It's almost gone. The home place ended up going for 70 grand, something like that, of which I got 3,200. Big smoggin' deal, huh? But anyway, I took a ride around our part of Martinsburg before the auction, and the store was still there, a mile down the road from the home place. And if you'd told me when I was a kid it was only a mile, I would have said you were full of shit up to your tick-tock. It was empty, all boarded up. For sale sign in front, but so faded you could hardly read it. The sign on the roof was actually in better shape, and that one said Mueller's General Store. Only we always called it Muley, see? Because that is what Daddy called it. Like he called U.S. Steel, U.S. Beg, Borrow, and Steal. And he'd call the Berg Pittsburgh Shitty, and... Ah, oh, damn it, Lisi. Am I crying?
Yes, Scott. Her voice sounds far away to her own ears. He takes one of the paper napkins that came with the picnic lunch and wipes his eyes. When he puts the napkin down, he's smiling.
Paul told me to be good when he was gone to Muley's, and I did what Paul said. I always did, you know?
She nods. You're good for the ones you love. You want to be good for the ones you love because you know that your time with them will end up being too short, no matter how long it is.
Anyway, when he came back, I saw he had 2 bottles of RC, and I knew he was going to make a good bool, and that made me happy. He told me to go in my bedroom and look at my books a while so he could make it. It took him a long time, and I knew it was going to be a long, good bool, and I was happy about that, too. Finally, he hollered to me to come out to the kitchen and look on the table.
Did he ever call you Scooter? Lisi asks.
Not him, not never. By the time I got out to the kitchen, he's gone. He's hiding. But I knew he's watching me. There's a piece of paper on the table that said bool. And then it said...
Wait a second, Lisi said. Scott looks at her, eyebrows raised. You were 3. He was 6, or maybe going on 7.
Right.
But he could write little riddles, and you could read them? Not only read them, figure them out?
Yes.
Raised eyebrows asking what the big deal is.
Scott, did your crazy daddy understand he was abusing a couple of smucking child prodigies?
Scott surprises her by throwing back his head and laughing.
That would have been the least of his concerns, he says. Just listen, Lisi, because that was the best day I can remember having as a kid. Maybe because it was such a long day. Probably someone at Gypsum Plant screwed up and the old man had to put in some serious overtime, I don't know. But we had the house to ourselves from 8 that morning until sundown.
No babysitter? He doesn't reply, only looks at her as if she might have a screw loose. No neighbor lady checking in?
Our nearest neighbors were 4 miles away. Muley's was closer. That's how Daddy liked it, and believe me, that's the way the people in town liked it, too.
All right. Tell me part 2. Scott and the good bool.
Paul and the good bool. The great bool. The excellent bool.
His face smooths out at the memory, one to balance the horror of the bench.
Paul had a notebook with blue-ruled lines, a Denison notebook. And when he made stations of the bool, he'd take a sheet out and then fold it so that he could tear it into strips. That made the notebook last longer, do you see?
Yes.
Only that day, he must have ripped out 2 sheets or even 3. Lisi, it was such a long bool.
In his remembered pleasure, Lisi can see the child he was.
The strip on the table said bool. The first one and the last one always said that. And then, right underneath...
10. Right underneath bool, it says this in Paul's big and careful capital letters. 1. Find me close in something sweet. 16. But before considering the riddle, Scott looks at the number, savoring that 16. 16 stations. He is filled with a tingling, pleasurable excitement. The best part of it is knowing Paul never teases. If he promises 16 stations, there will be 15 riddles. And if Scott can't get one, Paul will help. Paul will call from his hiding place in a spooky, scary voice. It's a daddy voice, although Scott won't realize it until years later, when he is writing a spooky, scary story called Empty Devils, giving hints until Scott does get it. More and more often, though, Scott doesn't need the hints. He improves swiftly at the art of solving, just as Paul improves swiftly at the art of making. Find me close in something sweet. Scott looks around and almost at once fixes on the big white bowl standing on the table in a moat-filled bar of morning sun. He has to stand on a chair to reach it and giggles when Paul calls out in his spooky daddy voice,
"Don't spill it, you mother."
Scott lifts the lid, and on top of the sugar is another strip of paper with another message printed in his brother's careful capital letters. 2. I'm where Clyde used to play with spools in the sun. Until he disappeared in the spring, Clyde was their cat and both boys loved him. But Daddy didn't love him, because Clyde used to wow all the time to be let in or out, and although neither of them says it out loud, and neither would ever dare ask Daddy,
They have a good idea that something a lot bigger and a lot meaner than a fox or a fisher got Clyde. In any case, Scott knows perfectly well where Clyde used to play in the sun and hurries there now, trotting down the main hall to the back porch without giving the bloodstains under his feet or the terrible bench so much as a glance. Well, maybe just one. On the back porch is a vast, lumpy couch that exudes weird smells when you sit down on it. It smells like fried farts, Paul said one day, and Scott laughed until he wet his pants. If Daddy had been there, wetting his pants would have meant big trouble, but Daddy was at work. Scott goes to this couch now, where Clyde used to lie on his back and play with the spools of thread Paul and Scott would dangle above him, reaching up with his front paws and making a giant boxing shadow cat on the wall. Now Scott falls on his knees and looks under the lumpy cushions one by one until he finds the third scrap of paper, the third station of the bool, and this one sends him to. It doesn't matter where it sends him. What matters is that long suspended day. There are two boys who spend the morning ranging in and around a slumped, distempered farmhouse far out in the country as the sun climbs slowly in the sky toward depthless, shadowless noon. This is a simple tale of shouts and laughter and dooryard dust and socks that fall down until they puddle around dirty ankles. This is a story of boys who are too busy to pee inside and so water the briars on the south side of the house instead. It's about a little kid, not that long out of his diapers, collecting slips of paper from the foot of a ladder leading up to the barn loft, from under the porch stoop steps, from behind the junked-out Maytag washer in the backyard, and beneath a stone near the old dry well.
"Don't fall in, you little booger,"
says the spooky daddy voice, now coming from the high weeds at the edge of the bean field, which has been left fallow this year. And finally Scott is directed this way. 15. I'm underneath your every dream. Underneath my every dream, he thinks. Underneath my every dream. Where is that?
Need help, you little booger? The spooky voice intones. Because I'm getting hungry for my lunch.
Scott is too. It's afternoon now. He's been at this for hours, but he asks for another minute. The spooky daddy voice informs him he can have 30 seconds. Scott thinks furiously. Underneath my every dream. Underneath my every... He's blessedly dequipped with ideas having to do with the subconscious mind or the id, but has already begun to think in metaphor. And the answer comes to him in a divine happy flash. He races up the stairs as fast as his small legs will carry him, hair flying back from his tanned and grimy forehead. He goes to his bed in the room he shares with Paul, looks beneath his pillow, and sure enough, there is his bottle of RC Cola, a tall one, along with the final slip of paper. The message on it is the same as always. 16. Bool. The end. He lifts the bottle as he will much later hold up a certain silver spade. A hero is what he feels like. Then turns around. Paul comes sauntering in the door, holding his own bottle of RC and carrying the church key from the things drawer in the kitchen.
Not bad, Scotto. Took you a while, but you got there.
Paul opens his bottle, then Scott's. They clink the long necks together. Paul says this is having a host, and when you do it, you have to make a wish.
What do you wish for, Scott?
I wish the bookmobile comes this summer.
What do you wish for, Paul?
His brother looks at him calmly. In a little while, he will go downstairs and make them peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, taking the step stool from the back porch, where their fatally noisy pet once slept and played, in order to get a fresh jar of sheds from the top shelf in the pantry, and he says, 11. But here Scott falls silent. He looks at the bottle of wine, but the bottle of wine is empty. He and Lisi have taken off their parkas and laid them aside. It has grown more than warm under the yum-yum tree. It's hot, really just short of stifling. And Lisi thinks, we'll have to leave soon. If we don't, the snow lying on the fronds will melt enough to come crashing down on us. 12. Sitting in her kitchen with the menu from the antlers in her hands, Lisi thought, I'll have to leave these memories. Soon, too. If I don't, Something a lot heavier than snow will come crashing down on me. But wasn't that what Scott had wanted? What he'd planned? And wasn't this bull hunt her chance to strap it on? Oh, but I'm scared. Because now I'm so close. Close to what? Close to what? Hush, she whispered, and shivered as if before a cold wind. One all the way down from Yellowknife, perhaps. But then, because she was two-minded, two-hearted, just a little more. It's dangerous. Dangerous, little Lisi. She knew it was, could already see bits of the truth shining through holes in her purple curtain, shining like eyes. Could hear voices whispering that there were reasons why you didn't look into mirrors unless you really had to, especially not after dark and never at twilight. Reasons to avoid fresh fruit after sunset and to fast completely between midnight and 6 a.m. Reasons not to unbury the dead. But she didn't want to leave the yum-yum tree, not just yet. Didn't want to leave him. He had wished for the bookmobile, even at the age of 3, a very Scott wish. And Paul? What was Paul's? 13. What, Scott? She asks him. What was Paul's wish? He said, I wish Daddy dies at work. That he gets electrocuted and dies. She looks at him, mute with horror and pity. Abruptly, Scott begins shuffling things back into the pack. Let's get out of here before we roast, he says. I thought I could tell you a lot more, Lisi, but I can't. And don't say I'm not like the old man, because that's not the point, okay? The point is that everyone in my family got some of it. Paul, too? I don't know if I can talk about Paul anymore now. Okay, she says. Let's go back. We'll take a nap, then build a snowman or something. The look of intense gratitude he shoots her makes her feel ashamed, because really, she was ready for him to stop. She's taken in all she can process, at least for the time being. In a word, she's freaked. But she can't leave it completely, because she's got a good idea of how the rest of this story must go. She almost thinks she could finish it for him. But first, she has a question. Scott, when your brother went after the RC Colas that morning, the prizes for the good bull? He's nodding, smiling. The great bull. Uh-huh. When he went down to that little store, Muley's, didn't anybody think it was weird to see a 6-year-old kid come in all covered with cuts? Even if the cuts were covered with band-aids? He stops doing up the buckles on the pack and looks at her very seriously. He's still smiling, but the flush in his cheeks has faded almost entirely. His skin looks pale, almost waxy. The Landons are fast healers, he says. Didn't I ever tell you that? Yes, she agrees. You did. And then, freaked or not, she pushes ahead a little farther. 7 more years, she says. 7, yes. He looks at her, the pack between his blue-jeaned knees. His eyes ask how much she wants to know, how much she dares to know. And Paul was 13 when he died? 13, yes. His voice is calm enough, but now all the red is gone from his cheeks, although she can see sweat trickling down the skin there, and his hair is limp with it. Almost 14. And your father, did he kill him with his knife? No, Scott says in that same calm voice, with his rifle, his .30-06, in the cellar. But, Lisi, it's not what you think. Not in a rage, that's what she believes he's trying to tell her. Not in a rage, but in cold blood. That is what she thinks under the yum-yum tree, when she still sees part 3 of her fiancé's story as the murder of the saintly older brother. 14. Hush, Lisi, hush, little Lisi, she told herself in the kitchen, badly frightened now, and not only because she had been so wrong in what she'd believed about the death of Paul Landon. She was frightened because she was realizing, too late, that what's done can't be undone, and what's remembered must somehow be lived with ever after. Even if the memories are insane. I don't have to remember, she said, bending the menu swiftly back and forth in her hands. I don't have to, I don't have to, I don't have to unbury the dead. Crazy shit like that doesn't happen, it... 15. It isn't what you think. She will think what she thinks, however. She may love Scott Landon, but she isn't bound to the wheels of his terrible past, and she will think what she thinks. She will know what she knows. And you were 10 when it happened? When your father...
Yes.
Just 10 years old when his father killed his beloved older brother. When his father murdered his beloved older brother. And part 4 of this story has its own dark inevitability, doesn't it? There's no doubt in her mind. She knows what she knows. The fact that he was only 10 doesn't change it. He was, after all, a prodigy in other ways.
And did you kill him, Scott? Did you kill your father? You did, didn't you?
His head is lowered. His hair hangs, obscuring his face. Then from below that dark curtain comes a single hard, dry, barking sob. It is followed by silence, but she can see his chest heaving, trying to unlock. Then,
I put a pickaxe in his head while he was asleep and then dump him down the old dry well. It was in March, during the bad sleet storm. I drug him outside by the feet. I tried to take him where Paul was buried, but I couldn't. I tried. But Lisey, he wouldn't go. He was like the first shovel. So I'd dump him down the well. So far as I know, he's still there. Although when they auctioned the farm, I was afraid.
He reaches out for her blindly, and if she hadn't been there, he would have gone right on his face, but she is there, and then they are. 16.
No, Lisey snarled.
She threw the menu, now so strenuously bent it was almost a tube, back into the cedar box and slammed the lid. But it was too late. She had gone too far. It was too late because... 17. Somehow they're outside in the pouring snow. She took him in her arms, under the yum-yum tree, and then boom, boom, they are outside in the snow. 18. Lisey sat in her kitchen with the cedar box on the table before her, eyes closed. The sunlight pouring in the east window came through her lids and made a dark red beet soup that moved with the rhythm of her heart, a rhythm that was just now much too fast. She thought, all right, that one got through. But I guess I can live with just one. Just one won't kill me. I tried. She opened her eyes and looked at the cedar box sitting there on the table, the box for which she had searched so diligently, and thought of something Scott's father had told him. The Landons, and the Landros before them, split into 2 types, Gomers and Bad Gunky. The Bad Gunky was, among other things, a species of homicidal mania. And Gomers? Scott had given her the lowdown on those that night. Gomers were your garden variety catatonics, like her very own sister, up there in Greenlawn.
If this is all about saving Amanda, Scott, Lisey whispered, you can forget it. She's my sis and I love her, but not quite that much. I'd go back into that hell, for you, Scott, but not for her or anyone else.
In the living room, the telephone began to ring. Lisey jumped in her seat as if stabbed and screamed. Chapter 9. Lisey and the Black Prince of the Inkunks. The Duty of Love. 1. If Lisey didn't sound like herself, Darla didn't notice. She was too guilty. Also too happy and relieved. Canty was coming back from Boston to help out with Mandy. As if she could. As if anyone can, including Hugh Albernus and the entire Greenlawn staff, Lisey thought, listening to Darla prattle on.
You can help, Scott murmured.
Scott, who would always have his say. It seemed that not even death would stop him.
You can, baby love.
Entirely her own idea, Darla was assuring.
Uh-huh, Lisey said.
She could have pointed out that Canty would still be enjoying her time away with her husband, entirely unaware that Amanda had a problem if Darla hadn't felt the need to call her, hadn't stuck her oar in, as the saying was. But the last thing Lisi wanted right now was an argument. What she wanted was to put the damned cedar box back under the mind-got bed and see if she could forget she had ever found it in the first place. While talking to Darla, another of Scott's old maxims had occurred to her. The harder you had to work to open a package, the less you ended up caring about what was inside. She was sure you could adapt that to missing items, cedar boxes, for instance. "Her flight gets into Portland Jetport just a little past noon," Darla was saying, all in a rush. "She said she'd rent a car, and I said, no, that's silly. I said I'll come down and pick you up." Here she paused, gathering herself for the final leap. "You could meet us there, Lisi, if you wanted. We could all have lunch at the Snow Squall, just us girls, like in the good old days. Then we could go up and see Amanda." Now, which good old days would those be, Lisi thought. The ones where you used to pull my hair? Or the ones when Candy used to chase me around and call me Little Lisa No Tits? What she said was, "You go on down and I'll join you if I can, Darl. I've got some things here I have to..." "More cooking?" Now that she had confessed to guilting Cantata into coming north, Darla sounded positively roguish. "No, this has to do with donating Scott's old papers." And in a way, it was the truth, because no matter how the business with Dooley McCool turned out, she wanted Scott's study emptied. No more dawdling. Let the papers go to Pitt, that was undoubtedly where they belonged, but with the stipulation that her professor pal should have nothing to do with them. Woodsmucky could go hang. "Oh," Darla said, sounding suitably impressed. "Well, in that case..." "I'll join you if I can," Lisi repeated. "If not, I'll see you both this afternoon, at Greenlawn." That was Jake with Darla. She passed on Candy's flight information, which Lisi obediently wrote down. Hell, she supposed she might even go down to Portland. At the very least, it would get her out of the house, away from the phone, the cedar box, and most of the memories that now seemed poised above her head like the contents of some terrible, sagging piñata. And then before she could stop it, one more fell out. She thought, "You didn't just go out from under the willow into the snow, Lisi. There was a little more to it than that. He took you..." "No!" she shouted and slapped the table. The sound of herself shouting was frightening, but it did the trick, lopped off the dangerous train of thought cleanly and completely. It might grow back, though. That was the trouble. Lisi looked at the cedar box sitting on the table. It was the look a woman might give a well-loved dog that has bitten her for no particular reason. "Back under the bed with you," she thought. "Back under the mind-got bed, and then what?" "Bool, the end, that's what," she said. Then she left the house, crossing the dooryard to the barn, holding the cedar box out before her as if it contained something either breakable or highly explosive. 2. Her office door stood open. From its foot, a bright rectangle of electric light lay across the barn floor. The last time Lisi had been in there, she'd left laughing. What she didn't remember was if she'd left the door open or shut. She thought the light had been off, thought she'd never turned it on in the first place. On the other hand, at one point she'd been absolutely positive that Goodma's cedar box had been in the attic, hadn't she? Was it possible one of the deputies had gone in there for a peek and left the light on? Lisi supposed it was. She supposed anything was possible. Clutching the cedar box to her middle almost protectively, she went to the open office door and looked in. It was empty, appeared to be empty, but... Without the least self-consciousness, she applied one eye to the crack between the jamb and the door. Zack McCool wasn't standing back there. No one was. But when she looked into the office again, she could see that the answering machine's message window was once more lit up with a bright red 1. She went in, tucked the box under one arm, and pushed the play button. There was a moment of silence, and then Jim Dooley's calm voice spoke. "Mrs., I thought we agreed on 8 o'clock last night," he said. "Now I see cops around the place. Seems like you don't understand how serious this business is. Though I should think a dead cat in a mailbox would be pretty hard to misunderstand." A pause. She looked down at the answering machine, fascinated. "I can hear him breathing," she thought. "I'll be seeing you, Mrs.,"
he said.
Smuck you, she whispered.
Now, missus, that ain't... isn't nice, said Jim Dooley,
and for a moment she thought the answering machine had, well, answered her. Then she realized the second version of Dooley's voice was in living color, so to speak, and had come from behind her. Once again feeling like an inhabitant in one of her own dreams, Lisey Landon turned around to face him. 3. She was dismayed by his ordinariness. Even standing in the doorway of her little never-was barn office with a gun in one hand, he had what looked like a lunch sack in the other. She wasn't sure she could have picked him out of a police lineup, assuming the other men in it were also slim, dressed in summer weight khaki work clothes, and wearing Portland Sea Dogs baseball caps. His face was narrow and unlined, the eyes bright blue, the face of a million Yankees, in other words, not to mention 6 or 7 million hillbilly men from the mid and deep south. He might have been 6 feet tall, he might have been a little under. The lick of hair which escaped the ball cap's round rim was an unremarkable sandy brown. Lisey looked into the black eye of the pistol he held and felt the strength run out of her legs. This was no cheap hawkshot 22. This was the real deal. A big automatic. She thought it was an automatic. That would make a big hole. She sat down on the edge of her desk. If the desk hadn't been there, she was pretty sure she would have gone sprawling on the floor. For a moment, she was almost positive she was going to wet her pants, but she managed to hold her water. For the time being, at least.
Take what you want, she whispered through lips that felt Novocaine numb. Take all of it.
Come upstairs, missus, he said. We'll talk about it upstairs.
The idea of being in Scott's study with this man filled her with horror and revulsion.
No, just take his papers and go. Leave me alone.
He stared at her patiently. At first glance, he looked 35. Then you saw the little fans of wrinkles at the corners of his eyes and mouth, and realized he was 5 more than that, 5 at least.
Upstairs, missus, unless you want to start this with a bullet in the foot. That'd be a painful way to talk business. There's a lot of bones and tendons in a person's foot.
You won't. You don't dare. The noise.
Her voice sounded farther away with each word. It was as if her voice were on a train, and the train was pulling out of the station. Her voice was leaning out of its window to bid her a fond farewell. Bye-bye, little Lisey. Voice must leave you now. Soon you'll be mute.
Oh, the noise wouldn't fuss me a bit, Dooley said, looking amused. Your next-door neighbors are gone. Off to work, I imagine. And your pet cop's off on a run.
His smile faded, yet he still managed to look amused.
You've come all over gray. Reckon you've had quite a shock to the system. Reckon you're gonna pass clean out, missus. Save me some trouble if you do, maybe.
Stop. Stop calling me.
Missus was how she wanted to finish, but a series of wings seemed to be enfolding her, wings of darker and darker gray. Before they grew too dark and too thick to see through, she was faintly aware of Dooley shoving the gun into the waistband of his pants. Blow your balls off, Lisey thought dreamily. Do the world a favor. And darting forward to catch her. She didn't know if he made it. Before the issue was decided, Lisey had fainted. 4. She became aware of something wet stroking her face and at first thought a dog was licking her. Louise, maybe. Except Lou had been their collie back in Lisbon Falls, and Lisbon Falls had been a long time ago. She and Scott had never had a dog. Maybe because they'd never had kids, and the two things just naturally seemed to go together like peanut butter and jelly, or peaches and
Come upstairs, missus, unless you want to start this with a bullet in the foot.
That brought her back fast. She opened her eyes and saw Dooley squatting before her with a damp washcloth in one hand, watching her. Those bright blue eyes. She tried to pull away from them. There was a metallic rattle, then a dull thud of pain in her shoulder as something snubbed tight and stopped her.
Ow! Don't yank and you won't hurt yourself, Dooley said,
as though this were the most reasonable thing in the world. Lisey supposed that to a nut job like him, it probably was. There was music playing through Scott's sound system for the first time in Christ knew how long, maybe since April or May of 2004, the last time he was in here, writing. Waymore's Blues. Not old Hank, but someone's cover version. The Crickets, maybe. Not super loud, not cranked the way Scott used to crank the music, but loud enough. She had a very good idea.
I am going to hurt you.
Of why Mr. Jim, Zach McCool, Dooley, had turned on the sound system. She didn't...
Places you didn't let the boys to touch.
Want to think about that. What she wanted was to be unconscious again, actually. But she couldn't seem to help it. The mind is a monkey, Scott used to say, and Lisi remembered the source of that one even now, sitting on the floor in the bar alcove with one wrist apparently handcuffed to a water pipe under the sink. Dog Soldiers by Robert Stone. Go to the head of the class, little Lisi. If, that is, you can ever go anywhere ever again.
Ain't that just the cutest song? Dooley said, sitting down in the alcove doorway.
He crossed his legs tailor fashion. His brown paper lunch sack was in the diamond-shaped hole thus formed by them. The pistol lay on the floor beside his right hand. Dooley looked at her sincerely.
A lot of truth in it, too. You did yourself a favor, you know, passing out the way you did. I tell you what.
Now she could hear the South in his voice, not all showy like the chicken shit asshole from Nashville, but just a fact of life.
Favor, tell you what.
From his sack he took a quart mayonnaise jar with the Hellman's label still on it. Inside, floating in a puddle of clear liquid, was a crumpled white rag.
Chloroform, he said, sounding as proud as Smiley Flanders had been of his moose. I was told how to use it by a fella, claimed to know, but he also said it was easy to do things wrong. At the very best, you would have woken up with a bad headache, missus. But I knew you wouldn't want to come up here. I had a tuition about that.
He cocked a finger at her like a gun, smiling as he did so, and on the sound system Dwight Yoakam began to sing A Thousand Miles from Nowhere. Dooley must have found one of Scott's homemade honky-tonk CDs.
May I have a drink of water, Mr. Dooley?
Huh? Oh, sure. Mouth a little dry, is it? A person has a shock to the system, that's gonna happen every time.
He got up, leaving the gun where it was, probably out of her reach, even if she lunged to the limit of the handcuff chain. And to try for it and come up short would be a bad idea indeed. He turned on the tap. The pipes chugged and glugged. After a moment or two, she heard the faucet begin to spit water. Yes, the gun was probably out of reach, but Dooley's crotch was almost directly over her head, no more than a foot away, and she had one hand free. As if reading her mind, Dooley said,
You could ring my chimes a damn good'un, if you wanted, I guess. But these are Doc Martens I'm wearing on my feet, and you're not wearing anything tall on your hands.
From Dooley, at all, came out one word, tall.
Be smart, missus, and settle for a nice, cool drink. This tap ain't been run much for a while, but it's clearing out a right smart.
Rinse the glass before you fill it, she said.
Her voice sounded hoarse, on the verge of breaking.
They haven't been used much, either.
Roger Wilco.
Just as pleasant as could be. Reminded her of anyone from town. Reminded her of her own dad, for that matter. Of course, Dooley also reminded her of Gerd Allen Cole, the original 5150 kid. For a moment, she almost reached up and twisted his balls anyway, just for daring to put her in this position. For a moment, she could barely restrain herself. Then Dooley was bending down, holding out one of the heavy Waterford glasses. It was 3/4 full, and while the water hadn't run entirely clear, it looked clear enough to drink. It looked wonderful.
Slow and easy does it, Dooley said in a solicitous tone. I'll let you hold the glass, but if you throw it at me, I'm gonna have to snap your ankle. Hit me with it, and I'll snap both of them for you. Even if you don't draw blood. I mean it, all right?
She nodded and sipped her glass of water. On the stereo, Dwight Yoakam gave way to old Hank himself, asking the eternal questions. Why don't you love me like you used to do? How come you treat me like a worn-out shoe? Dooley squatted on his hunkers, his butt almost touching the raised heels of his boots, one arm wrapped around his knees. He could have been a farmer watching a cow drink at a stream in the North 40. She judged he was on alert, but not on high alert. He didn't expect her to throw the clunky drinking glass, and of course he was right not to expect it. Lisi didn't want her ankles snapped. "Why, I've never even taken that all-important first inline skating lesson," she thought. "And Tuesday nights are singles nights at Oxford Skate Central." When her thirst was slaked, she held the glass out to him. Dooley took it, examined it.
"You sure you don't want them, those, last two swallers, missus?"
Not even close to swallers, and Lisi had a sudden tuition of her own. Dooley was exaggerating the good old boy thing. Maybe on purpose, maybe even without realizing it. When it came to language, he corrected up, because he would have been pretentious to correct down. Did it matter? Probably not. "I've had enough." Dooley polished the last two swallows off himself, his Adam's apple sliding in his skinny throat. Then he asked her if she was feeling any better.
"I'll feel better when you're gone."
"Fair enough. I won't take up much of your time."
He tucked the gun back into his waistband and got to his feet. His knees popped, and Lisi thought again, marveled, really.
"This is no dream. This is really happening to me."
He kicked the glass absently, and it rolled a little way onto the oyster-white wall-to-wall carpet out there in the main office. He hitched up his pants.
"Can't afford to linger in any case, missus. Your cop'll be back, him or another. And I got an idea you got some kind of sister twister going on as well, isn't that so?"
Lisi made no reply. Dooley shrugged as if to say, "Have it your way," and then leaned out of the bar alcove. For Lisi it was a surreal moment, because she had seen Scott do exactly the same thing many times, one hand gripping each side of the doorless doorway, feet on the bare wood of the alcove, head and torso out in the study. But Scott would never have been caught dead in khakis. He had been a blue jeans man to the end. Also, there had been no bald spot at the back of his head.
"My husband died with a full head of hair," she thought.
"Awful nice place," he said. "What is it? Converted hayloft? Must be."
She said nothing. Dooley continued to lean out, now rocking back and forth a little, looking to the left, then right. Lord of all he surveys, she thought.
"Real nice place," he said. "Just about what I would have expected. You got your three rooms, what I'd call rooms, and your three skylights, so there's plenty of natural light. Down home, we call places all a row like this shotgun houses or sometimes shotgun shacks. But ain't nothing shacky about this, is it?"
Lisi said nothing. He turned to her, looking serious.
"Not that I begrudge him, missus, or you, now that he's dead. I did some time in Brushy Mountain State Prison. Maybe the prof told you that. And it was your husband got me through the worst of it. I read all his books, and you know which one I liked best?"
"Of course," Lisi thought, "Empty Devils. You probably read it 9 times. But Dooley surprised her.
"The Coaster's Daughter. And I didn't just like it, missus. I loved it. I've made it my business to read that book every 2 or 3 years since I found it in the jailhouse library, and I could quote you whole long passages of it. You know what part I like the best? Where Jean finally talks back. Tells his father he's leaving, whether the old man likes it or not. Do you know what he tells that miserable, holy, rolling old fuck? Pardon my French.
That he has never understood the duty of love," Lisi thought. But she said nothing. Dooley didn't seem to mind. He was on a roll now, enraptured.
"Jean says his old man has never understood the duty of love. The duty of love. How beautiful is that? How many of us have felt something like that, but haven't never had the words to say it? But your husband did. For all of us who otherwise would have stood mute. That's what the prof said. God must have loved your man, missus, to give him such a tongue."
Dooley looked up at the ceiling. The cords on his neck stood out.
"The duty of love. And the one God loves best he takes home soonest to be with him.